You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.
Hello and welcome to this Times Higher Education issue review podcast for the edition covering the 30th of July to the 5th of August 2015. My name's Chris Parr, I'm joined by Deputy News Editor John Morgan, reporter Ellie Bothwell, writer Matthew Rice and News Editor Simon Baker. The £18,000 a year new College of the Humanities set up by philosopher A.C. Grayling has announced which institution is to validate its degrees. Is it Oxford? Is it Cambridge? Manchester maybe? No, it's none of those. Find out who it is in just a moment. Here's a clue. It's a post-92 institution on the South Coast. Find out in a second. What can be found lurking in university art collections? And what's the purpose of such collections in the first place? Matthew has been looking into this for his feature. And is the key to wiping out society's inequality simply teaching students to be thoroughly pleasant people? Research suggests that it just might be. That plus other highlights from our news sections come later in the podcast. First, John, you've got the splash this week. A.C. Grayling set up his new College of the Humanities in 2012. It's attracted some big-name academics, some sky-high entry requirements, and it's teamed up with another UK institution now which is going to validate its degrees.
That's right. So since it opened in 2012, New College of the Humanities has been offering University of London degrees. So essentially, it's just been offering some teaching for students, but then the students go to the University of London, take a University of London exam and get a University of London degree. But from this September, New College of the Humanities will be offering degrees validated by Southampton Solent University, which, as you mentioned, is a post-1992 university, so some people might see there's perhaps an unusual fit there between a college that charges £18,000 a year and bills itself as offering an Oxbridge-style education, but in fact the degrees awarded will bear the crest of Southampton Solent University. Mm-hmm. And the reason that New College of the Humanities wants to do this is because, as its chief executive Jeremy Gibbs explained to me, it eventually wants to have its own degree awarding powers, and for a private college to get its own degree awarding powers, it has to have a 4-year track record of teaching degrees validated by universities, so hence why they've gone down this route. It's under the current system, it's the only way they can get their own degree awarding powers, but I guess it might raise some questions about students at NCH paying £18,000 a year for their degrees, while the students at Southampton Solent will be paying £9,000 a year. So I guess that'll raise some interesting questions. And one of the things that degree awarding powers would do for NCH is it would allow it to expand, to sort of provide competition for universities, and it would also make it more attractive to investors, and we know that last year the college was seeking £10 million of investment from potential corporate investors.
Mm. It sounds like a stepping stone though. You think that in 4 years' time this will be job done, and that the aim for the institution will be that it can stand on its own 2 feet?
That's certainly what the government would like. I think there's people sort of certainly within the Treasury, I gather, that regard NCH as, you know, a really important institution in potentially providing competition for universities and innovation. And another couple of key developments that have happened, the college has also got permission from the government for its students to claim public loans funding, so they can get loans for their tuition fees of up to £6,000 a year.
So they've still got to find 12
from the public loan system. So yeah, see, they're going to have to bridge the rest of the gap themselves unless they get a scholarship. And Jeremy Gibbs also said that they're hopeful they might get some probationary license from the Home Office to recruit overseas students. And you can imagine that there are potentially a lot of students overseas who would very much like to come and study in Oxbridge style, for an Oxbridge style education as it's billed. So that's likely to be a really big stepping stone for them as well. And they're hopeful that this could begin in the autumn, or if not the year after. And Jeremy Gibbs told me that there's two of the big breaks on their development so far have been inability to recruit overseas students. as well as the absence of government finance. So there's quite a lot of key developments going on there at the moment.
Interesting stuff. Yeah, I'm sure international students would be interested in an Oxbridge education, whether it would be one that would be validated with a degree by the University of Southampton Solent. It's not for me to say. Moving on to the feature section. Matthew, your feature this week is on university art collections. You've been blogging about this as well. The big question, I guess, is why do institutions have these sometimes vast collections of artworks? What's the use to the institution?
Well, let me start. I think I first got interested in this because there's what's now Murray Edwards College in Cambridge has got a collection of women's art, which they've put together over the last 20 or so years, and it's now, I think, the largest in Europe. And this, it's an all-women's college. So it has a very obvious rationale. It's a very coherent collection. It raises a lot of interesting questions, of course, about what one means by, if anything, one means by women's art and how distinctive it is. So this seems like a really kind of interesting and sensible thing to be doing, a real addition to the kind of cultural landscape. So then I thought, well, let's look at some of the other universities and see what kind of art collections they've got. And a lot of them have kind of clearly acquired collections pretty piecemeal, you know, pictures of long forgotten vice chancellors and, you know, something somebody thought would look nice on the walls years ago and now looks totally out of fashion, and so on. And there's a sort of unwritten rule that people don't sell off these collections. Well, Holloway caused a bit of a scandal when they sold off some rather valuable paintings. So the question is whether they do have any particular function, and I wrote around to a lot of universities and got some pretty spectacularly unhelpful replies. But fortunately, I got some some quite interesting ones as well. I mean, the University of Warwick has a rather interesting story. They, when it was founded in the 60s, the original architect was a great fan of modern art and put modern art all over the campus. And of course, not everybody particularly likes that sort of art with the students and staff, and it's, you know, come into a fair bit of criticism over the years. And now there's a professional curator, and one of the sort of amusing things is when they got a professional curator, they put put signs by all the paintings of the dates and provenance and so on. And a guerrilla critic came and took over and did sort of this sort of rather serious art historical comments on the photos. He said things like, "Oh God, not another of those stripy pictures," and things like that. And until they noticed it was a slightly different typeface, they hadn't realised that there'd been a sabotage from within. And so I think, you know, in a way, Warwick was one of the several utopian universities of the 1960s, and you can kind of track what has happened to those ideals in a way through the art collection. Mm-hmm. And the only other, there are several interesting examples, but one of the other interesting ones is Royal Holloway University of London. They've got sort of two collections of largely Victorian art, and they now are using that much more in teaching and research, and it's kind of being built into the mission of the university. They also have a well-known painting which is called Man Proposes, God Disposes, which is a picture of polar bears savaging the human remains and ships of an unsuccessful Arctic expedition. And this was in the main hall, and it was considered to be cursed, so it was always covered up with a Union Jack during examinations. A really bizarre superstition. But now they've actually sort of a formal opening, and so students and other people can actually go and see it uncovered.
Very good, very good.
And face all the dangers. So.
Indeed. Well, it's a wonderfully illustrated piece as well, as you might imagine, that picture of the polar bear is there, as indeed is one of those stripy ones I can see from over here as well. That's probably about the level of my art critic as well, to be honest. Do check that out on page 38 this week in the magazine, and on timeshighereducation.co.uk as well. And back in the news section, Ellie, you've written about a paper this week that might just have answered one of the most stubborn questions in higher education, which is how do you make the US HE system a little bit more equal? It's quite simple, isn't it?
Yeah, well, it's a bit of a revelation, really, because it turns out you've just got to teach your students to be nice.
That's
so
it.
That's good. it's interesting. The authors, Alexandra and Helen Astin, have actually been working for 45 years on that question. And in this sort of retrospective piece, they've concluded that the structural barriers that stand in the way of achieving equality in American higher education show little sign of changing.
And so they've given up?
Yeah, sort of. They've sort of said, you know, there are various barriers, so the hierarchical system of institutions, the reliance on standardised test scores, the lack of government support for public universities. And they basically said, you know, this is going to continue. It's continuing to affect poor and minority ethnic students. But actually, if you could just teach some of the students to be nicer, to become more just, to become citizens who are committed to creating a more just society, then actually you might solve some of these equality issues.
So the policymakers of today are beyond help. We need to create an entirely new generation that will, in future, then solve these problems. Sorry, Simon.
No, I was just going to say, I was just wondering how they were going to achieve this through teaching students necessarily. Well, it's like the interesting fact I sort of thought about the story, the one right at the bottom, which was kind of it quotes some research from the Higher Education Research Institute in the US and their annual sort of survey of first years. And it showed that being very well off financially was endorsed as a very important or essential value by 82% of first year students, while developing a meaningful philosophy of life was endorsed by 45%. And those qualities had swapped places in students' hierarchy of value since the 1960s.
It's quite depressing, isn't it?
But I thought that was pretty interesting. But really, that just reflects the way society's gone, rather than really anything that, you know, is being taught in universities necessarily. So I just wondered how they were going to go about actually doing it through teaching. But, you know, there's certainly an interesting solution to the problem.
Yeah, I mean, obviously it'd be an interesting sort of challenge. I don't know how long it would take, how many students you'd have to teach to be nice to make this kind of change. It's perhaps a little bit defeatist as well. You kind of, I don't know, does that mean all the lobbyists should stop trying to change policy if it's not going to work anyway? I don't know, but it's nice to think maybe that the students actually have more power in their hands.
Yeah, just need to get them all together and join hands and head off to San Francisco with flowers in their hair, and it'll be fine. Before we go, Simon, any other highlights we should look out for in this week's news section?
Well, a couple of stories I wanted to kind of particularly draw attention to, which were Paul Jumper's done a very interesting analysis this week in our research intelligence slot, page 20 of the magazine this week. And he's Elsevier basically helped by doing some analysis of authorship of their publications to sort of show how mobile researchers are in each country. And there's a really interesting graphic that we've produced here, which shows which countries have the most mobile researchers and which ones have the least mobile, and also which countries have a highest proportion of brain gain, so they have a larger inflow of researchers than outflow, and those that have a larger brain drain. What's interesting about the brain drain table is that the UK comes third on that after Belarus and Cuba for the highest proportion of, well, for the larger outflow of researchers than inflow, which wouldn't necessarily be a bad thing. It might just reflect the fact that a lot of researchers or academics from Britain are mobile and travel around the world and then come back and bring that knowledge. So rather than kind of anything that's necessarily means that researchers go and then never come back. So that doesn't necessarily mean it's a bad thing, but something that Paul points out. Most mobile national cohorts of researchers, Switzerland, I suppose that might be something you might expect. Saudi Arabia, which I suppose, you know, is another place which is trying to draw a lot of researchers to the country. But yeah, it's a very interesting set of statistics, I'd say well worth looking at. Another thing I just wanted to mention was page 8 this week, ahead of clearing, which starts in only a couple of weeks now. A-level results are out, I think, on the 13th of August. And clearing is going to be very interesting this year because the cap on undergraduate numbers is completely been lifted now, and universities are free to recruit as many students as they want. So it's going to be a bit of a bum fight. And, you know, That's the technical term. So some universities are going to, are free to expand as much as they want, leaving others maybe struggling to pick up students. What's interesting about this story is that the University of Central Lancashire has been criticised basically by the General Pharmaceutical Council, which accredits pharmacy education, for the Master of Pharmacy degree that UCLan has is a four-year course of combined bachelor's and master's degree that you'd start as an undergraduate. And they criticised the UCLan for basically lowering their entry standards and clearing to try and boost their intake. And that is something that has been definitely identified by various people as a tactic universities, they're worried that universities might use to try and get more people in with the number cap being lifted. So I'd say that's well worth a read.
An interesting case study indeed. Well, that's all for this week's THE Issue Review podcast. If you want to comment on any of the stories we've discussed or indeed anything in the magazine, you can do so on our website at timeshighereducation.co.uk underneath any story. You'll find us on Twitter at Times Higher Ed. You'll also find us by searching on Facebook, on Google+, on LinkedIn. So do get in touch. Well, that's all for this week's THE Issue Review podcast.
You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.